Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sadigaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Abhay Charan Day became prominent in the pharmaceutical business. He worked well for Bosch's laboratory, and other companies wanted him as their agent. He had hopes of becoming rich. Srila Prabhupada, my Guru Maharaj ordered me, you do this, but I thought, let me first of all become a rich man, then I shall do. In the beginning, I was thinking, now my godfathers have taken sannyas. They are begging from door to door. Why shall I beg? Let me earn money and start Krishna consciousness. The biggest pharmaceutical company in India, Bengal Chemical, made him an offer, but when they did not fulfill all his conditions, he turned them down, though later he regretted it. Still, there were good signs. The astrologer had predicted he could become one of India's richest men, and Dr. Kartik Bose had told his father-in-law, he's a very intelligent man. But there were also other signs. As many accounts he had secured by his wide travels, there were also that many bills to collect. Many of the accounts began to fall behind in their payments, and the accumulated debt began to grow until he owed Bosch's laboratory a total of 10,000 rupees, and Abhay had enemies. The manager had taken over Abhay's old position as office manager within Bosch's laboratory in Calcutta, tried to turn Dr. Bose against Abhay, insinuating that he was too independent. They had heard of his negotiating with Bengal Chemical, and the new manager attributed the accumulating debt to Abhay's lack of loyalty to the home office. Kartik Bose remained favorably inclined towards Abhay, but when the debt became a financial strain, he went to Allahabad to investigate. At Prayag Pharmacy, he spoke with Dr. Ghosh, who told him, he is a very honest man. It is no fault of his. In good faith, he gave all these chemists drugs and credit, but he can't realize the money. All right, Dr. Bose said, but I can't go on giving him money. Abhay went over the accounts with Dr. Kartik Bose, and they agreed that the best way to settle the matter was for Dr. Bose to take over the Prayag Pharmacy and all of Abhay's accounts. Thus, Abhay was absolved of debt, but unemployed. Atulananda Brahmachari approached him. Why didn't you come to the Mat? Now you are free. Abhay began to visit more frequently the nearby Rupa Goswami Mat, where the Gaudiya Mat men, in their renounced Brahmachari spirit, suggested that he depend completely on Krishna, give up the world, move in with them, and become a full-time preacher. But for Abhay, there was no question of abandoning business. If he did, what would happen to his wife and children? He and Radharani now had a third child, a son, so the financial responsibility was increasing. The Brahmacharis were well-intentioned in asking him to renounce the world, and it was fine for them to do so, but Abhay couldn't take it very seriously. Without work, he was in a critical situation. But he remained confident and eager to take on new employment. There were other companies that would like to have him as their agent, and some of his old customers wanted him to service them, even if they weren't Bosch's man. Abhay thought about starting his own pharmaceutical laboratory. Finally, he decided he would start his own factory, but in a much bigger city than Allahabad. He settled on Bombay. He decided that his family should remain in Allahabad, and he and his brother would travel to Bombay, take an apartment, and survey the prospects for starting a factory there. Although Radharani was used to her husband's traveling, it had never been as extended as this promised to be. Abhay talked with her, explaining that his recent business loss had been the arrangement of Krishna. Now again, to provide for his family, he would have to start a large business, and that could best be done in a major city like Bombay. But family life in Allahabad would be temporarily disrupted. He set up a very small pharmaceutical manufacturing operation there in Allahabad, put his nephew Tulsi in charge, and left for Bombay with his brother. In Bombay, Abhay rented an apartment on Grant Road, and applying the knowledge he had gained as manager of Bose's laboratory, started his own pharmaceutical factory. Business was going well when a large company, Smith Institute, wanted him as their sales agent. Abhay took the job, thinking that he could earn money as Smith's representative while at the same time developing his own business. He was confident of his ability to earn money in the pharmaceutical line. While traveling around Bombay on business, Abhay met some members of the Gaudiya Math, Bhakti Raksha Sridhar Maharaj and Bhakti Sharanga Goswami, senior sannyasi disciples of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. Bhakti Sharanya Goswami, means next to the road that comes from the Goshala, and then it goes out and goes to the main road, right? So when it hits the main road on the right side, if you're facing the Ganga, that's Goswami Mat. That's Bhakti Sharanga Goswami's Mat. Abhay recognized them as respected godbrothers, well-versed in the scriptures and Vaishnava philosophy. It seemed he was destined to find his godbrothers wherever he went. Both he and the sannyasis regarded their apparently odd meeting in the city as auspicious. Like the members of the Gaudiya Math he had met in Allahabad, these preachers had no permanent center, but they were trying to start one. On behalf of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, they were going door to door soliciting supporters for a Bombay branch of the Gaudiya Math. Abhay wanted to help. As a fellow godbrother in the service of a spiritual master, he offered them his services. Although as sannyasis, they were in a superior position. In their somewhat helpless condition, they looked up to Abhay for help. They had been staying in a small place on Proctor Road and had found little opportunity to make important contacts. Now they formed a team. Abhay introduced the sannyasis to business acquaintances and the sannyasis taking donations for the new centers. Abhay Charanaravinda was good at collecting funds, and he willingly gave his time. Again, his godbrothers began pulling him to participate fully in the Gaudiya Math preaching. Srila Prabhupada. We made a party for collecting alms, Sridhar Maharaj, Goswami Maharaj, and myself. I took them to some of my chemist and doctor friends, and in 2 days we collected 500 rupees. Sridhar Maharaj would speak, I would introduce, and Goswami Maharaj would canvass. So Goswami Maharaj very much appreciated, and he began to speak highly about me. For a Babu, he is so expert. He has got so many friends, and he has collected so much. Why should he not be in charge of our mutt? Why shouldn't he live with us? Why is he living separately? Abhay visited the mutt headquarters on Proctor Road, where he joined the devotees in Kirtan and heard them speak from the Bhagavatam. At the sannyasi's request, Abhay took on the responsibility of finding a more suitable place for the Bombay center. Wherever he went in the city, he looked for likely locations, just as he had responsibilities for his wife and family in Allahabad. By dint of his initiation, he was responsibly bound to assist his godbrothers. He had to take part in the preaching, not simply struggle so that he might exist in the world of business competition. But he didn't think he could ever live like the sannyasis. No possessions, no business, sleeping on the bare floor, taking only simple meals. Yeah, that was when Srila Prabhupada, Krishna had asked Prabhupada to come down to the material world, he was explaining one time. But his complaint was, it's so austere here, right? You know, the facilities aren't nice, the food's not nice, you know, it's just, the place is just too, you know, rough. But Krishna said, don't worry, I'll take care. So we see the same thing reflected here, is that The sannyasis say move into the mud, but he's saying, no, it's just too simple, too austere. February 25th, 1935. It was the 62nd birthday of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. At Jagannath Puri, where Srila Bhaktisiddhanta was residing, the devotees observed the day with ceremony. At the small Bombay center, a few disciples planned an evening observance and invited local people for the occasion. Abai wrote a poem. Adore ye all the happy day, blessed than heaven, sweeter than May. When he appeared at Puri, the holy place, my Lord and Master, his divine grace. O my Master, the evangelic angel, give us thy light, light up thy candle. Struggle for existence, a human race, the only hope, his divine grace. Misled we are, all going astray. Save us, Lord, our fervent pray. Wonder thy ways, turn our face. Adore thy feet, your divine grace. Forgotten Krishna, we fallen souls, paying most heavily the illusion's toll. Darkness around, all untrace, the only hope, his divine grace. Message of service thou hast brought, a healthful life, as Chaitanya wrought. Unknown to all, it's full of grace. That's your gift, your divine grace. Absolute is sentient, thou hast proved. Impersonal calamity thou hast removed. This gives us a life, anew and afresh. Worship thy feet, your divine grace. Had you not come, who had told the message of Krishna, forceful and bold? That's your right. You have the mace. Save me, a fallen, your divine grace. The line of service, as drawn by you, is pleasing and healthy, like morning dew. The oldest of all, but in a new dress. Miracle done, your divine grace. Abai Charan Das. Abai had also composed a speech, which he read before the assembled guests and the members of the Gaudiya Math. Although his first language was Bengali, his English was clear and natural. So it's the speech. Gentlemen, the offerings of such a homage as has been arranged this evening to the Acharya Dev is not a sectarian concern, because when we speak of the fundamental principles of Guru Dev or Acharya Dev, we speak of something that is of universal application. There does not arise any question of discriminating my guru from that of yours or anyone else's. There is only one guru who appears in an infinity of forms to teach you, me, and all others. The Guru, or Acharya Dev, as we learn from the bona fide scriptures, delivers the message of the absolute world. I mean the transcendental abode of the absolute personality, where everything non-differentially serves the absolute truth. Like the poem, the speech was personal, but even more than the poem, it was authoritative, philosophical preaching. The Grad brothers were impressed to hear Abai presenting the Vaishnava philosophy so expertly. How was it possible? Of course, it should not have come as a surprise. He had heard the Vaishnava philosophy from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, just like his God brothers. Why should he not be able to enunciate the teachings of a spiritual master? Having heard from him and having read Gita and Bhagavatam, and Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, was he not a devotee in the parampara? But until now, no one knew he could preach in English so expertly. Continuing the speech. Therefore, if the absolute truth is one, about which we think there is no difference of opinion. The Guru also cannot be two. The Acharya Dev, to whom we have assembled tonight to offer our humble homage, is not the Guru of a sectarian institution, or one out of many differing exponents of the truth. On the contrary, he is the Jagat Guru, or the Guru of all of us. The only difference is that some obey him wholeheartedly, while others do not obey him directly. The Guru of whom Abhay spoke was Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, the representative of the original compiler of the scriptures. The representative of the original compiler of the scriptures, Vyasadeva. Abhay explained how Lord Krishna had delivered transcendental knowledge to Brahma, the creator of this particular universe. From Brahma, the knowledge had descended to Narada, from Narada to Vyas, and from Vyas to Madhva. Because Srila Bhaktisiddhanta was presenting the Vedic knowledge as is, without any interpretation, in parampara, he was the bona fide acharya who could enlighten others with the revealed knowledge of the Vedas. Abhay continued, "Gentlemen, our knowledge is so poor, our senses are so imperfect, and our sources are so limited that it is not possible for us to have even the slightest knowledge of the absolute region without surrendering ourselves at the lotus feet of Sri Vyasadeva or his bona fide representative." This transcendental knowledge, Abhay explained, had been known in India for thousands of years, and this knowledge, although presently obscured, was India's real gift to the world. So he's establishing that as there's only one personality of Godhead, therefore knowledge of him, there is only one guru. Now he may have many representations, manifestations, but the point is that the bona fide guru in speaking about Godhead, then the same information is going to be given. Right? So then there's no difference. There's only one Godhead. Late night again. No. Yes? No? Yes. Possibly. Maybe. So then continue. "We must conclude that the darkness of the present age is not due to lack of material advancement, but that we have lost the clue to our spiritual advancement, which is the prime necessity of human life and the criterion of the highest type of civilization. Throwing of bombs from aeroplanes is no advancement of civilization from the primitive, uncivilized way of dropping big stones on the heads of the enemies from the tops of hills. Improvement of the art of killing our neighbors by inventing machine guns and by means of poisonous gases is certainly no advancement from primitive barbarism priding itself on its art of killing by bows and arrows, nor does the development of a sense of pampered selfishness prove anything more than intellectual animalism. Thus, while others were yet in the womb of historical oblivion, the sages..." Historical oblivion. In the womb of historical oblivion. "The sages of India had developed a different kind of civilization, which enables us to know ourselves. They had discovered that we are not at all material entities, but that we are all spiritual, permanent, and non-destructible servants of the Absolute." See, this kind of preaching then can be spoken to anyone, because the non-sectarian means that it's not, yes.
What does oblivion mean?
Oblivion. Oblivion means basically into like, it's basically like a nothingness, you know. So if you say that they're in the womb of historical oblivion, oblivion means that they are not even yet, you know, they're so undeveloped And but that, even that, is within the situation of historical, like, doesn't, has no meaning. Like, oblivion is kind of like, you know, doesn't, it's nothing, no meaning, not recognized, nothing of importance. You know what I'm saying? It's just completely, you wouldn't even think about it or consider it. You know what I'm saying? Like that. So the modern civilization, just because it's become very expert at, you know, its military skills, it's not doing anything really different, Prabhupada says, than before, that your different uncivilized people would be on the top of a hill and that, and drop rocks off onto their enemies, or shoot them with bows and arrows. The same thing is accomplished, maybe a little bit more efficiently, but it's not really an improvement. You know, it'd be just like, let us say you cooked lunch and it was really terrible, but it was a small amount, right? And it was cooked, you know, not so well in, you know, so let's say some clay pots on, you know, a couple of bricks with a couple of sticks that you tried to make a fire with. But the end result was terrible. Now all we've done is made nice, you know, we've arranged nice gas stoves, nice big pots, all things nice arranged, but what we cook is just as terrible. You understand? You don't understand. You understand? Okay, okay, that kind of, I didn't quite catch the... Yeah. Yeah. And, or on the other side, that they're very expert at just, you know, self-centered or selfish pampering. You know, they have very, very nice facilities for themselves. Right? Then we call that developed. Does that make sense? So he's saying that's not, okay, that's what the modern civilization has focused on. But when the, and that's now. So now when the sages, back when the Western civilization was very undeveloped, then at that same time, the sages in India had understood the nature of the soul and that it's not being connected with the material energy, it being something different, something transcendental, spiritual. So they understood the importance and of spiritual enlightenment, of self-development and all that. So that's been going on for thousands of years. You know, already, just you could say, in the known history, like that. We know from the scriptures that it's always been there. But the point is compared to Western civilization, which they're starting, you know, some thousands of years ago, that the sages were already very developed at that time. The speech continued, describing the horrible consequences of a misspent human life, the sufferings of repeated birth and death. Again and again, Abhay stressed the need to surrender to the spiritual master. He criticized empirical mundane philosophers, godless politicians, and blind sense gratifiers. He repeatedly pointed to the soul's nature and sublime position as the servant of God, and as the servant of the pure devotee of God. Abhay, an initiated disciple of a spiritual master, for little more than 2 years, referred to himself as a student, continued, "Gentlemen, although we are like ignorant children in the knowledge of the transcendence, still His divine grace, my Gurudev, has kindled a small fire within us to dissipate the invincible darkness of the empirical knowledge, and we are so much on the safe side that no amount of philosophical argument of the empiric schools of thought can deviate us an inch from the position of our eternal dependence on the lotus feet of His divine grace. And we are prepared to challenge the most erudite scholars of the Mayavad school on this vital issue, that the personality of Godhead and His transcendental sports in Goloka alone constitute the sublime information of the Vedas." So he's saying is that the instructions received from his spiritual master are so great that no amount of mundane philosophers and all their varieties of speculation and arguments can distract one even an inch from being fixed at the lotus feet of the spiritual master, right? So in other words, that's the standard. Just because all these other people aren't satisfied with Krishna consciousness, what does it matter? You know what I'm saying? It's just like, you know, the ants, the cockroaches, all everything else, they are very satisfied to move into your house and take over. But does that mean that's the way it's going to be? So because you have to make an arrangement by cleaning and putting up various kinds of, you know, oils and other things that make them uncomfortable, is that a bad thing? No, that's just living your proper lifestyle. So therefore, disturbing in the performance of your duties, if it's appropriate, if others become disturbed, what can you do? You know what I'm saying? If you're doing your duties properly, then it falls on them that they are, you know, having difficulty. Does that make sense? But to worry about persons who they themselves aren't of a standard to lead the people, right? In other words, if they're the leaders of their people, but they are unqualified, why should we be worried that they're disturbed? Especially when we see that the people that they are leading are very happy with what we're doing. Does that make sense? Yes? No? He then ended his speech with an eloquent prayer of submission. Personally, I have no hope to have any direct service for the coming crores or births of the sojourn of my life, but I am confident that some day or other I shall be delivered from this mire of delusion in which I am at present so deeply sunk. Therefore, let me with all my earnestness pray at the lotus feet of my divine master to let me suffer the lot which I am destined to do for all my past misdoings, but to let me have this power of recollection that I am nothing but a tiny servant of the Almighty Absolute Godhead, realized through the unflinching mercy of my divine master. Let me, therefore, bow down at his lotus feet with all the humility at my command. He submitted both the poem and the speech to the harmonist. The poem, Abai's first publication, announced him as a competent writer in English, and Swami Bhakti Pradeep Tirtha, editor of the harmonist, informally dubbed Abai as Kavi, learned poet. Some of Abai's godbrothers also picked up on the name and began calling him Kavi. Most of them, even the sannyasis, were not so proficient in English, but Abai was not ordinary. They could appreciate that the poem was personal, written out of Abai's genuine worship and his joy at having accepted a genuine spiritual master. But it was also written strictly in accordance with the conclusions of the scriptures. For Abai, however, the glory of his Sri Vyas Puja homage came when the poem reached Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And gave him pleasure. One stanza specifically made Srila Bhaktisiddhanta so happy that he made a point of showing it to all his guests. Absolute is sentient, thou hast proved. Impersonal calamity, thou hast moved. I always thought it was removed. It's just moved. Yeah, moved. Somehow, Somehow in this simple couplet, Abai had captured the essence of his spiritual master's preaching against the Mayavadis. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta took it as an indication of how well Abai knew the mind of his Guru Dev. Abai was delighted when he heard that the couplet was pleasing to his spiritual master. One of Abai's godbrothers compared this verse to a verse in which Rupa Goswami had expressed the inner thinking of Lord Chaitanya and had thus moved him to ecstasy. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati also found the essay pleasing, and he showed it to some of his confidential devotees. He instructed the editor of The Harmonist, quote, "Whatever he writes, publish it." Abai thought it was only natural that he should have many business enemies or competitors. It was a sign of success. So Prabhupada didn't have a problem with people being inimical. Then that means you're doing something, right? If you do nothing, can you create an enemy? Right? No. It's because you're doing something, then that makes people upset, because you are moving in a direction that makes others feel insecure. Right? That's then how you get enemies. So if you're preaching very nicely, and because of that, their enemies are developing. Preaching nicely means you're preaching and you're getting results. People are listening, people are inspired, people are taking up Krishna consciousness. It's spreading. Then, naturally, there'll be enemies, right? Not that because there's enemies, we shouldn't be preaching so much. You understand? Very important. But his Bombay competition caused him to lose another good chance to become wealthy. The enemy was the son of Abhai's supervisor at Smith Institute. Both son and father complained to the Smith Institute executives that Abai Charan was pushing goods from his own laboratory and not Smith's. By this intrigue, Abai lost his position with Smith Institute, and his supervisor placed his own son as the new agent. Abai was again on his own. In other words, in the material world, people are motivated. They have that's why they're here. They have their own motivation. So it's a very common thing. But because of this, then you don't have that idyllic cooperation. That cooperation can actually only be found if people are God conscious, right? Because then they have the similar focus. Everybody's connected to the Lord. But if one is not God conscious, it's very rare they can cooperate. And if they are God conscious to that degree that they're focusing on this element of cooperation, then they can move forward. But otherwise, then what's going to happen is one's always going to find there's going to be somebody who's not doing things properly. So it has no problem. That makes no problem with Krishna consciousness. It makes no problem with the process of Krishna consciousness, the goals going back to Godhead. All it means is the place where you practice your Krishna consciousness isn't so ideal. Right? And where is that place? Here, yes, means the material world. Right? Or do you mean here, right there, where you're sitting now is?
Material world.
But so where you're sitting now is okay, it's favorable. No one's pinching, poking, or harassing. While continuing to help his sannyasi godbrothers in Bombay, he found a two-story building for rent at Gaulia Tank Road. Everyone agreed it would make a suitable center, and Abai arranged for the rental and for initial repairs and helped the sannyasis move in. It seemed that his endeavors for spiritual things were always successful, whereas his business efforts were continuously failing. Of course, a few business enemies were no cause for discouragement. Intrigues and losses were always part of the game, and he was still well known in the pharmaceutical business throughout India. So in other words, spiritually everything was going very nicely, right? But materially not so nicely, but that's part of dealing with the material world. It doesn't go nicely, right? That's the meaning of it, right? So his point was, that's no reason, if that's what you're supposed to be doing, that's no reason to be discouraged. But as we see, is that he would try to balance, you know, his engagement in the spiritual activities with all his business endeavor and family. Yes? No? But it wasn't so much the give and take of business that disturbed him as his own doubts about whether this was the best way for him to serve his spiritual master. Business was good only if it could go side by side with his spiritual life. Lord Chaitanya had said that the chanting of Hare Krishna should be spread to every town and village, and Abai wanted to assist his spiritual master in fulfilling that prophecy, especially by contributing money and helping establish centers. His earnings should not go solely for his family. Right, so he's having a doubt on whether being engaged in the business is the best engagement, right? Since he's supposed to be able to connect everything, try to help spread Krishna consciousness to every town and village. And so then here he sings that his idea is by doing the business, then he can help by establishing centers and helping with the preaching, because then he'll have funds for it. Ideally, family life and spiritual life should progress side by side. But the difficulty was Abhai's wife. She was disturbed over the business losses and apathetic to the spiritual successes. She wanted to stay within the orbit of home and family. And despite Abhai's suggestions, she refused to accept initiation from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. It was his own wife who was his most formidable competitor, and she waged her opposition right in the home, where it was least welcome. Right, so he has the business competitors outside, but inside then his wife is also then creating this whole thing, because she's not that interested in spiritual life. So anything that he does there to her is not something special or, you know, wonderful. You know, and then the losses in the business, and that's great calamity and everything like that. So we see that this total difference in, you know, our lack of support then eventually doesn't work out so well for the wife like that. So that should always be noted. But we see is that Abhai's point was the difficulty was not day-to-day affairs in the home. It was a lack of the home being interested in God consciousness, right? Or at least being supportive of it. Does that make sense? In other words, Prabhupada's difficulty is not because he has difficulty working with his wife and with his family. Right? We never see any problem there. It's just the family's lack of interest in God consciousness. Does that make sense? It's a difference. When Abhai occasionally visited his family in Allahabad, he tried to satisfy them with his good intentions. Business had not gone so well in Bombay, but he had new plans, and he assured his family that there was no need to worry. He planned to do more preaching in his home. The whole family could become more involved in spiritual activities. He wanted to invite guests, hold discussions on Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, perform kirtan, distribute prasadam. He wanted to preach, just as his spiritual master and godbrothers were preaching. Such a program wouldn't require that a sannyasi or brahmachari come and preside. Abhai could do it himself. This would be an example of the ideal household life. But Radharani was unsubmissive. Rather than coming to hear him speak, she stayed with the children in another room, taking tea. Not good program. In other words, this is his interest, so therefore she's supportive of that. It's nice. Because he's taken it where he can do these things with them. So not only will they get the benefit of hearing and everything like that, but then the things are also in their house, so they get the benefit of that preaching, the programs that are there, right? And the nice association. So from all sides, he's made arrangement that the family itself will also get the benefit. So it's not just himself, but they didn't want to take part. In Bombay, Abhay associated with Sridhar Maharaj and Bhakti Saranga Goswami. Both sannyasis were highly literate scholars. Sridhar Maharaj was respected for his erudition in the Shastras, and Bhakti Saranga Maharaj for his writing and preaching in English. Sometimes Abhay would discuss his realizations with them. Abhay had also studied the scriptures on his own. His spiritual master's commentary on the Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, as well as commentaries by the previous acharyas. While reading Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on Bhagavad Gita, second chapter, 41st verse, he read that the disciple should consider the order of the spiritual master to be his life and soul. These words produced a deep effect on Abhay, strengthening his desire to execute Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's command. And in the 88th chapter of the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, he came upon a verse in which Lord Krishna said something that startled him. Yasyaham anugrihnami harishye tadhanam shanai tato dhamnam tyajantyasya swajana dukha dukitam. When I feel especially merciful, this is Krishna speaking, when I feel especially mercifully disposed towards someone, I gradually take away all his material possessions. His friends and relatives then reject this poverty-stricken and most wretched fellow. Abhay shuddered as he read the verse. It seemed to speak directly to him. But what did it mean? Does it mean, he thought, that Krishna will take away all my money? Was that what was actually happening? Was that why his business plans were failing? He discussed the meaning of the verse with Sridhar Maharaj. Yes, Sridhar Maharaj confirmed, this might very well be what was happening between Lord Krishna and Abhay. Right, because spiritually everything was developing. And even though he was so expert and had such a solid base and such great skill, every time he would open something with some business, it would fail, it would fall apart. Right? So Krishna has some plan like that. In July 1935, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati came to install the deity of Lord Krishna and to institute deity worship at the Bombay Center. Hare Krishna. Oh, okay.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Very good, thank you. Hare Krishna.
I have to give class in the temple, that's why I'm leaving now, Maharaj.
Okay. Very good, thank you. Hare Krishna. He was pleased with what his disciples had done so far. And Bhakti Saranga Maharaj admitted that much of the work was due to Abhay Babu, who had collected funds and established the new center. Why is Abhay Babu living separately? Bhakti Saranga asked. He should be president of this Bombay center. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati replied, it is better that he is living outside your company. He will do when the time comes. He will do everything himself. You don't have to recommend him. Abhay had not been present when this was spoken, but his godbrothers told him what Srila Bhaktisiddhanta had said. These words of a spiritual master, with their mysteriously prophetic air, were important to Abhay. He treasured the words within himself and meditated upon their meaning. Right, so the sannyasis are saying that he's so qualified, why doesn't he move into the mat, become the president of the mat and all this? Why he's living outside? The Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, no, better he lives outside for now. He'll do everything in the future. So he sees, and in the future he established an ISKCON. Because if he stayed within the mat, then that means you're whichever mat you're in, then you're just one small little particle within the Gaudiya mission that has no cooperation between the various particles. Does that make sense? So you have hundreds of preachers who don't cooperate together. How much can you do? But then he established ISKCON, where you have hundreds of preachers who do cooperate with together. So therefore, how much you can do. You know what I'm saying? It just means in like in 30 years, or say 40 years, then the ISKCON mission has, you know, like 400 centers. Right? While the Gaudiya mission in, you know, double that time, you know, only has, you know, 100 centers or more. You know what I'm saying? Not much at all. And those centers don't cooperate with each other. You know what I'm saying? So that's what he meant, prophetic. Bhaktisiddhanta said, don't worry. He lives outside, right? Because he's going to do everything. In November 1935, he was again with his spiritual master in Vrindavan. It was Kartik again, the ideal time to visit Vrindavan. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta was staying for a month with his disciples at peaceful Radhakund, the sacred lake where Radha and Krishna used to sport. After leaving Bombay in July, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had gone to Calcutta, where he had spoken on radio, delivered many public lectures, welcomed back the preachers he had sent to Europe, and finished publishing his Srimad Bhagavatam translation and commentary. Then in October, he had come to Radhakund. Occupying the small one-story house Bhaktivinoda Thakur had constructed, he had been reading and speaking to the assembled devotees on the Upanishads, Chaitanya Charitamrita, and Srimad Bhagavatam. He had also installed deities at Sri Kunja Vihari Mat. The banks of Radhakund were overhung with bright green foliage, growing from the gnarled branches of ancient tamarind, tamal, and neem trees. In the shallows of the water, cranes stood on stilt-like legs, while river terns skimmed across the lake, sometimes abruptly diving for fish. Sometimes a tortoise would poke its nose up from the water's depth, or a fish would jump. Green parrots, usually in pairs, flew in and out of the green trees, and sparrows chirped and hopped from place to place. Peacocks were also there, mostly in nearby gardens, as were occasional rabbits and even deer. Right, so you can see is at that time it was very, very pleasant. There would be the kuns and very little else there. Like that, so it was very, very nice, very green and lush. Now with time it's been very built up, so I'm not even sure that there's any trees, only that one on the beginning of the bridge of Janavadevi at Raghunath Das Goswami's Bhajan Kutir. Other than that, I don't think there's any trees on the bank.
There is one on Shyamakund, the Bhima tree?
On Shyamakund's side, there's a little bit more because people didn't build up on it as much. You can see is there a little bit back from it, but on Radhakund, they're right up to the edge, you know, it's built. The atmosphere is enriched with the history of Krishna Lila. 5,000 years ago, Radha and Krishna had engaged in transcendental pastimes here, and only 500 years ago, Lord Chaitanya had rediscovered Radhakund. Lord Chaitanya's great follower, Raghunath Das Goswami, had resided here for many years, constantly chanting Hare Krishna and discussing the activities of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And here in a small bhajan kutir, Krishna's Kaviraj had written Chaitanya Charitamrita, the narrative of the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati relished so much. Many of the inhabitants at Radhakund were Babajis, living in small bhajan kutirs and spending their time chanting Hare Krishna. Okay, so end here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare.
Prabhupada ki.